Welcome to Today's Issues. Join us for the next hour as we offer a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Ed Vitagliano.
And welcome to Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today. I am joined in studio by Fred Jackson, news director for American Family News and One News Now. Good morning, Fred.
Good to be here sitting in for Walker.
Yes, you're sitting in for Walker because Walker and his wife Lexi have had their twins.
Yes, the much talked about, anticipated.
Yes.
For months now. The babies were born, we're told, last evening.
I think it was last evening.
Yeah, about 20 minutes apart.
Yeah.
The two boys.
And he's got three boys now.
Yeah, Walker figured they'd come out running.
Yes.
They were getting big enough. But congratulations.
Almost 8 pounds apiece. They were right up there. So
Walker and Lexi, hey, way to go, guys.
Yeah, we're happy for them. And so thank those of you who took to heart our request that you pray for that family for the delivery of their twins. Everything has gone well. We're grateful to God for that and happy for the family.
Absolutely.
Also joining me in studio is Chris Woodward, news anchor for American Family News. Chris, good morning.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Yes. And so as I do, I like to just point out, I'm sitting in for Tim. You're sitting in, I guess you're sitting in for me.
Yeah, actually,
you'd be sitting in for me.
Yeah.
And then Chris is sitting in for you.
That's right.
So if we maybe we can confuse people
have
a little bit more.
Figured
later,
out who's on third?
No,
Brent.
Who's on first?
Yeah.
All right. So, Chris, you are the one who brings the stories this morning. What do we got?
Well, I want to begin with pro-life news. Oftentimes, we begin with political stuff, and certainly there's reasons for that. People need to be aware. But let's begin with some pro-life news, beginning in the great state of Mississippi. For a long time now, legislators here have been talking about a heartbeat bill. This is a bill that would ban most abortions once a baby's heartbeat is detected, usually around the 6 weeks mark. A lot of people are familiar with this because many states have taken this step, but here in Mississippi, there has been legislation that's been passed, and Governor Phil Bryant is expected to sign it today or sometime very, very soon. And I want to begin with some sound here. This is clip five, Brent. I've got sound from Dr. Jamison Taylor of the Mississippi Center for Public Policy down in Jackson, and he told me that in addition to saving the baby, this also protects the health and safety of women.
Roe v. Wade is old case law based on old science. It is also dangerous case law. According to the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute, the risk of a mother dying as a result of an abortion increases more than 2,100% beginning after 8 weeks. Maternal mortality increases by 38% with every week after 8 weeks gestation. The heartbeat bill is going to advance the state's interest in protecting maternal health.
Now, few, if any, of state laws like this have made it through the court system. But should that stop legislators from talking about and passing laws like this?
No, I mean, obviously, I would be in favor of these kinds of laws, and some people may. Some people might argue on the, from the pro-life side that this is a compromise, that we need to just work on getting Roe versus Wade completely overturned. To me, I think these are both and, not either or. I think you want to try the best you can to shrink the number of abortions in this country, and these kinds of laws can do that. I'm optimistic about this, although the pro-abortion side fights, you know, vigorously to kill every baby they can. All right, and I don't mind putting it that way. I tend to think that at some point science is going to shed itself of its ideology. Many scientists, many in the medical community, and stop thinking about this in terms of ideology and policy and start thinking in terms of what medical knowledge increasingly is saying, which is babies feel pain at a very young age. This heartbeat, this moment is very important, and I hope that this will, you know, tend to shape laws regarding abortion. I didn't know this interview that you did. I didn't know that abortion as the further along, I knew in late term, third trimester abortions, that it got much more dangerous for the mother. But I didn't know, I didn't realize it was so early on that this danger, abortion poses a great danger to the life of the mother and goes up the the longer the pregnancy goes. Mm-hmm.
I think what's also happening out there, I think there is a shift in the thinking of the culture. When you look at the crowds that show up for the March for Life in January, and we've remarked about this before, the number of young people
right.
that are in the pro-life movement, and I think that's going to play into the politics of all of this as more young people demand, wait a minute, it is a life. Also, there is you mentioned science. There is the science that's becoming very sophisticated. We've seen pictures of babies being operated on. They partially remove them from the womb and fix a spinal problem or whatever the case may be, heart problems,
yes.
while the baby's just 4 or 5 months along. So all of that, I think, is coming together to make people realize more and more that indeed it's a human being. The other thing that has happened, and this has been around for a while, when you have, let's say you have a drunken driver, he hits a car driven by a lady who's pregnant.
Right.
And both the lady and the baby die. The guy who is the drunk driver gets charged with two murders.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's always boggled my mind. Wait a minute. Now, you're arguing out there on one hand, if you're arguing for abortion, that it's not a human being. But on the other hand, if you have an incident like that, the accused gets charged with two counts of murder.
Right.
Yeah.
Murdering a baby. I mean, there's this great contradiction in thinking, but I think behind it all is, of course, it's a human being.
And I just have to believe that arguments like you're making and what you're talking about in terms of younger people being more pro-life, I'd also throw in, and I'm talking about reasons why I'm optimistic that this fight can be won in terms of life. There's the psychology of it. I mean, when I first became a Christian back in 1979, this is a long time ago, almost 40 years ago. Well, I guess it would be 40. But anyway, it was much more difficult to have a discussion with people theoretically about abortion because we didn't have 3D ultrasounds. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the scientific ability, the knowledge to do these surgeries where you see a baby's hand grabbing the, you know, the famous shot, mm-hmm. grabbing the pinky finger of the surgeon.
Yeah.
Things like heartbeats. Mm. These are things that have a dramatic impact on a woman going in for an abortion. This is why Planned Parenthood, which is the largest provider of abortions in the world, I think, certainly in our country, this is why groups like that and their ilk, they fight so hard against a heartbeat bill or even a bill which requires a woman going in to have an abortion mm-hmm. to hear the heartbeat or to see the 3D image or even the video of what they are about to kill.
Yeah.
Now, if you are really for women's choice and you are Planned Parenthood, why wouldn't you say, yeah, absolutely, we agree that the woman should see because we want her to absolutely know what she's doing so she can make an informed choice. No, they don't want women to hear the heartbeat. They don't want women to see the 3D or the 4D ultrasound video because they want to shroud this deed in secrecy because they understand that a woman who sees that image and says, that's not a blob of tissue, that's a baby.
Yeah.
They're more likely to walk out the door, and Planned Parenthood loses money.
Yeah.
Every time someone does that.
And one of the concerns with Planned Parenthood, another concern with Planned Parenthood is they pour a lot of money into campaigns for presidential candidates
right.
or members of the Senate. Senate candidates or House of Representative candidates. So they spend a lot of time making sure they get the people they want in office so that way they can continue to do what you just said there.
Right. For it's sure. big money for this company.
It is.
And they get big federal dollars, large amounts of almost half $1 billion of taxpayer funds, talking about Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. This is big money for them. Plus, they are ideologically driven in this quest to kill as many babies as possible.
Yeah.
Every time they say we want to, like then candidate Bill Clinton way back in the early 90s, and then as president, and then Hillary Clinton also, we want to make abortion legal, safe, and rare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to make it rare, then Planned Parenthood, you would be in favor of showing women that they're about to kill a baby, mm-hmm. not a blob of tissue.
You know, and you brought up an interesting point early on in the discussion. Certainly everybody here is familiar with what New York has done. They want to allow abortion up until birth. Virginia has been open to it. Rhode Island, Vermont, New Mexico tried it, but there are actually some 8 Democrats stood up and said, hey, we shouldn't do this. You know, and the argument for the argument in those states is this is a state's right. This is in the event Roe v. Wade is ever turned around or turned over. And so because they're saying it's a state's rights issue, people should be okay with it. These are states saying this is our state's right to decide what is. I'd be curious if someone brings that up in court when one of these cases, maybe even out of Mississippi, winds up in the legal system. Time will tell there. Speaking of lawsuits, the ACLU, it looks like, has fought for and won a block on a new Kentucky law that bans abortions on babies with Down syndrome. Kentucky, I think Indiana has done this as well, but Kentucky wanted to make it illegal to just automatically have an abortion because your baby has been found to have Down syndrome and things like this. The reason I bring it up today is because it is World Down Syndrome Day. This is a day where we observe and celebrate babies, many of us are familiar with, that have Down syndrome. I know my daughters went to school today wearing mismatched socks because of part of a campaign where people bring up the different chromosomes and things like that that determine Down syndrome. And here we have an organization, the ACLU, saying this is not right, and a judge, unfortunately, an Obama appointee, U.S. District Judge David J. Hale, saying, okay, Kentucky, you can't do this. So while we have good news in Mississippi, we've got some unfortunate news in Kentucky, but we'll see whether or not that gets challenged and fought in court beyond just what the ACLU has done here. But beautiful babies, world, kids with Down syndrome, certainly we're familiar with that here at the ministry, and we pray that this succeeds, if you don't mind me saying so, on the show.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So the battle goes on the pro-life front, and don't want our listeners to be discouraged because the battle to end slavery took, for example, in the British Empire, took many, many decades.
Sure.
And Christians should not lose heart because this is absolutely on the right side of the issue if you're fighting for life. Mm-hmm. And so folks, keep fighting, keep praying, keep writing legislators in your state and at the federal level, and keep fighting, keep praying that God will change the hearts of those in the judiciary, since we have so many activist judges, or change their seat, one or the other. So,
all right,
what else we got?
Well, looking now to Washington, D.C., President Trump is supposed to sign an executive order today involving campus free speech. We've talked about it. Certainly our news has covered it. There's been all kinds of incidents from California to the East Coast about where conservatives are being, their rights are being infringed upon. And on college campuses today. President Trump's going to sign an executive order saying this is not right. If you allow this to happen, if you turn a blind eye to it, you risk losing some federal funding and things of that sort. Later today, I'm supposed to talk with somebody that'll be at the White House for the signing of the executive order. But we do have some sound right now. This is clip 2, Brent. It's commentator Ben Shapiro talking about President Trump's executive order. And he says he'd like to see the specific language, but the intent is good.
Presumably, it will help people on college campuses who are trying to exercise their free speech and are prevented from doing so by the administration. I think the real question, as with all executive orders, is how's it legally drawn up? Just the lawyer in me wants to know that the Constitution is being followed, that all of the laws are being used, and that this isn't sort of an overreach. But I don't know that until I've seen the text. The generalized idea of protecting the First Amendment by connecting, for example, university funding for research to their adherence to the First Amendment, that seems perfectly acceptable to me.
Now, this is not, federal law. It's an executive order. So
right.
President Trump's successor at some point in the future, be it in 2021 or some point beyond that, might have a difference of opinion and do something differently. So would you still be in favor of seeing some federal legislation here that would protect free speech on campus, regardless of who's saying it?
Yeah, I'm not sure what else you can do. And now, Ben Shapiro, I'm a big fan of Ben Shapiro. He does a great job on college campuses debating and defending, debating leftists and defending conservative values. But he has been under the gun before at some of these colleges and universities where he's been banned or usually it's people trying to shout him down. He's had to have on occasion extra security, those kind of things to protect him. I'm doing air quotes. So he and others like him who will go right into the lion's den, so to speak, and make speeches defending conservative values. And then they take all kinds of questions. It's always fascinating to watch the exchanges he has. So if you have to threaten college campuses and universities with withholding federal funds, that may be the only way you can do it, because these campuses are overrun with leftists.
Yeah.
And many of them are Marxists, out-and-out Marxists, and they hate conservative values, and they have taught an entire generation to hate it. That's why you'll get student groups saying, we don't need to have so-and-so, X, Y, or Z on our campus. And it's getting to be a real battle just to get the other side on campus. So I'm with Ben Shapiro on this. I'm not sure how much strength is behind a resolution. Mm-hmm. I think Congress would have to actually tie the purse strings and money to these colleges and universities. But it is at least indicative of the fact that there's a problem, gets people talking about it, and maybe we can have change in the future.
Well, it's interesting. Berkeley and other colleges have already responded to this. They say, oh, we have policies protecting free speech, and we don't need an executive order. And they probably have something in writing mm-hmm. with regards to free speech, but they've tried little tools to get around all of that. One of them, and you mentioned Shapiro and security, one of the excuses they've used is, okay, if such an individual, be it Shapiro or whoever, is coming on campus, we know a whole pile of students aren't going to like him. But we're going to force you, let's say it's a college conservative group, to pay for that security.
Right.
And they don't have that kind of money.
Yeah.
As simple as that. The other thing they pull out of the hat is, here's a guy who has spoken out against homosexuality. And that's offense. That goes against our non-discrimination policy here on this campus. And as a last resort, they would go to court and say you can't withhold federal funds. I can just imagine the judge saying you can't do that. So I'm with you guys. It has to go beyond. I think it's good what the president is doing. He's signaling this will get a lot of coverage today.
Right.
He is signaling there is a problem.
Yes.
Number one. With conservatives having the ability to do what the left has always been able to do, bring in speakers,
right,
and just have a time where a conservative speaker can be treated with some degree of respect and open it up to questions from the audience. Why do you believe what you believe?
Yeah,
this is the old thinking of university was it's a place where you can go and explore ideas.
Yeah.
How can you explore ideas when you don't allow certain ideas to even be mentioned?
And the irony is that those who are in charge of college campuses now were on college campuses in the 60s and early 70s demanding the right to have their voices heard.
Yes.
And now that they're in charge, they don't want the other voices being heard.
Yeah.
Now, that's we can call that hypocrisy. Yes. I'm not the kind of guy who uses those kinds of terms.
Go ahead. You have free speech.
Yeah. That's hypocrisy.
As Ben Shapiro would say, facts don't care about your feelings.
Right. He does. And he does a great job. I like watching him interact with students.
He does. Now, one thing I wanted to continue from yesterday. You mentioned delicious irony yesterday.
Yesterday,
I'm going to use
did.
That in a news story somewhere today. So keep listening, folks. But I want to skip to clip 7, Brent. This here is a very young then Delaware senator by the name of Joe Biden. Saying Franklin Delano Roosevelt's idea to pack the courts was a bonehead idea. Clip 7.
President Roosevelt clearly had the right to send to the United States Senate and the United States Congress a proposal to pack the court. It was totally within his right to do that. He violated no law. He was legalistically absolutely correct. But it was a bonehead idea. It was a terrible, terrible mistake to make. And it put in question for an entire decade, the independence of the most significant body, including the Congress, in my view, the most significant body in this country, the Supreme Court of the United States of America. The president had the right to do that. He was totally within his power. and his objective was seen clearly.
Now, the reason I bring this up is because we spent a lot of time talking about it yesterday. I had news stories on it. I'm sure the other programs here on this great network talked about it. But Joe Biden also, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that he's going to run for president. And a lot of the people that want to beat him for the party's nomination are saying we got to have as many as 15 or more people. All the more justices, the merrier. Do you think this will come back to haunt him?
Well, it's becoming, I think I saw one headline yesterday, a litmus test. If you want to run for president and you're a Democrat, you're going to have to favor this. So what is Joe Biden going to do with regards here's what you were saying back then. He'll come up with it.
He will.
Different.
Yes, that's exactly what he'll say. Just like Chuck Schumer and others in the Senate and in the House of Representatives who have said, well, yeah, I those quotes that are out there of me saying we need a wall on the southern border, I've changed my mind. Times have changed. Circumstances have changed.
Yeah.
We've moved beyond the time back in, he was probably in the 70s, you know, when he was making that statement, Joe Biden, or maybe the 80s. And the fact of the matter is the news media is not going to grill him on him changing his mind. Yeah. You change your mind as a Republican, you get grilled by the mainstream news media. If you change your mind and it's politically expedient for you to do so and you're a Democrat, the mainstream media gives you a pass and covers you.
Yeah.
And they'll agree with you. So
I think it was the early 80s that he said.
I didn't realize, though, Fred, that this is becoming one of the main issues for the Democrats who are running for president.
Oh, yeah. And it's very popular. And it all has to do with right now you have a Republican in the White House and the Republicans still control the Senate.
Yeah.
So basically, it's who decides who's going to be nominated to go on a federal court, on the Supreme Court. It's really in Republican control right now.
Right.
And so this is them saying we have to stop this. They understand the ramifications of this. I think 50 of President Trump's nominees have made it through the process now, federal judgeships.
Yeah.
So very rapidly, this is one of the successes you don't hear talked about very much.
You hear about it on AFR, but
not on other places.
You need to donate, folks.
Yeah, not on other media, but he's being fairly successful. They're pushing these through. Mitch McConnell is doing his job.
You have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had a health scare again.
Yes.
This year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or maybe it was last fall last year. So it's possible for her that she retires, and then you're looking at yet another conservative. This is making Democrats very nervous.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Well, sticking with this real quick, I want to move to clip 9. Speaking to Fox News Channel about
now we are. This is going to have to be how quick do we have?
I can get it in there. Christopher Scalia, son of late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, said that one element of what these candidates are suggesting is just unconstitutional. Clip 9.
Candidates have said that to pack the court, you should have 15 justices, and you get those justices by having Democrats pick 5, Republicans pick 5, and then those 10 justices pick 5 more. The problem with that is obviously Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution makes very clear that the president has the power and authority to nominate.
Now, that proposal, real quick, for people listening, is the one that Beto O'Rourke has thrown out there. We talked about it yesterday. You can check it out on the podcast.
Yeah, you'd have to amend the Constitution to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, what Joe Biden was saying was that the president can put a proposal to Congress to make certain changes, but that sounds like they're going to have to amend the Constitution. Well, desperate times require desperate measures, apparently, if you're a Democrat. So anyway, we'll continue to follow this. I had no idea this was a big thing for Democrats running for the nomination for their party. We'll continue to follow it. Who knows what's coming down the pike. All right, we're going to take a two-minute break for news. When we come back, Jan Markell and Brian Fisher, both here on Today's Issue.
On the next Today's Issues.
Walker Wildman is handling our Facebook presence in the world.
Yeah, if you have a Facebook account, just type in Today's Issues in your search bar, and then our page will pop up. And you can watch the show there every day, or you can view all the articles that we talk about.
Right, but you can also be our friend.
Don't miss the next Today's Issues. Weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on American Family Radio and on Facebook.
80% of the time, an abortion-minded mother who views an ultrasound or sonogram of her baby will choose life. Here's the story of Candace.
The sonogram sealed the deal for me. My baby was like this tiny little spectrum of hope. And I saw his heart beating on the screen. And knowing that there's life growing inside, I mean, that sonogram changed my life. I went from just Candace to mom. Thank you to everybody that has given these gifts. You guys are giving more than money. You guys are giving love.
There are currently preborn centers which do not have an ultrasound machine. Would you sponsor a machine today? Dial pound 250 and say keyword baby. That's pound 250 and say baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Your love can save a life.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
An honor denied. That story coming up. Since 1971, Liberty University's values have been defined by a commitment to excellence and a biblical worldview. Their mission of training champions for Christ has remained the foundation of everything they do. It's that mission that propels Liberty students to excellence in the classroom and beyond. More than 550 programs of study from undergrad to doctoral degrees, effectively preparing students to enter a competitive job market. Visit liberty.edu to learn more. That's liberty.edu. Boris Kazenko is a 16-year-old student at Holmdel High School in New Jersey. He has a 4.0 grade point average, volunteers in the community, and is active in conservative politics. He's also a supporter of President Trump. And Boris says that's the reason he was excluded from the National Honor Society. The school district refuses to comment on what happened, but Boris said he was denied membership because of a character issue. Last year, the 16-year-old got in trouble as the sophomore class president. He posted an inspirational Trump message on the school's Instagram page. And when he ran for junior class president, he got in trouble for wearing a shirt that read, "Make Holmdel Great Again." Boris says he's not all that bothered by the National Honor Society snub because he received a better invitation to the White House to meet President Trump. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today, joined in studio by Fred Jackson, news director for American Family News and One News Now, and Chris Woodward, news anchor for American Family News. On Thursdays, most Thursdays, we have the privilege of hosting our next guest, who I think is one of the favorites on American Family Radio, Jan Markell, founder of Olive Tree Ministries and host of the radio program Understanding the Times, heard on weekends on American Family Radio, Saturdays from 1 to 2 p.m. Central Time and Sunday from 12 to 1 p.m. Central Time. Jan, welcome to Today's Issues.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for having me.
Well, we normally try to get some stories together to pitch to Jan. You know, it's kind of like when we have Abraham Hamilton III on. He's our legal eagle. We throw legal questions to our legal expert. And so Jan is an expert of sorts on the Middle East and Bible prophecy. What kind of stories do we want to talk to Jan about?
Yeah, morning, Jan. It's Fred here.
Hi, Fred.
How you doing? I was going to make some smart aleck remark about it being the first day of spring, but that means nothing in Minnesota.
Right.
our spring begins in July. So.
That's right. So I'm going to refrain from making any smart aleck.
Hey, July 4th, it's the first day of spring in Minnesota.
Oh, there you go.
Hey, listen, yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Jerusalem and having a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I tell you what, it was one of those cases where you had great appreciation going back and forth between the two gentlemen.
Yes.
I want to play you a little bit from that news conference that they held at the end of their meetings. First, you're going to hear from Prime Minister Netanyahu, but I want you to listen what the Secretary of State of the United States, Mike Pompeo, had to say about the growing problem of anti-Semitism. He talks about that towards the end of this clip. Cut number four.
This partnership, which I think is exceptional, first of all, I think it's supported by the broad swathe of the American people. We appreciate that, the fact that we have a broad base of support in the United States. But we also know that our alliance in recent years has never been stronger.
With the dark wave of anti-Semitism rising in Europe and in the United States, all nations, especially those in the West, must go to the barricades against bigotry. Our challenge is especially urgent as the hot rhetoric of prejudice cloaks itself in the language of the academy or of diplomacy or public policy. Sadly, we in the United States have seen anti-Semitic language uttered even in the great halls of our own capital. This should not be.
There you have it. That was our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And I don't think there's any secret, Jan, of what he was referring to in recent days in our nation's capital. We now have some people who have been elected to office are not afraid to show they're very anti-Semitic.
Right. We actually have now three Muslims in Congress, Representative Carson from Indiana, and the newer ones, Representative Omar from the Twin Cities, and Representative Tlaib from Michigan, and then AOC, Representative Ocasio-Cortez. I don't know, she's made some statements that are pretty troubling, but all that said, that's at least four that are making some reckless statements. And Mike Pompeo was very honest there. He said, you know, there's anti-Semitism going on all over, but now we've got it in America.
Hmm.
And not that that's brand new, it really isn't, but on a level like probably not seen before because of some of the aforementioned who are making, again, some careless statements and some dangerous statements. And then you have Congress trying to draft some kind of statement that's to push back on all this, and then they back down on that and make it too real generic. And like someone said, we've got some sentiment, and it's creeping into America right now, that's leading to a sentiment that was prominent during World War II. What is happening to our country? I think we have to ask that question. It's a very legitimate question.
Jan, it's Chris here. On Fox News today, there was a story, and the headline is this: Far Left MoveOn.org asks 2020 presidential candidates to skip next week's pro-Israel AIPAC conference. Here's the thing, though. Like, the events, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is supposed to be there, as well as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So why would they have an issue with presidential candidates going?
I think that's a good question. I did actually see that headline and that article. I just think that I think that the Democrat Party wants to distance itself from all things Israel. I think we can all remember 2012. It wasn't that long ago when at their convention, forget what city it was in, but at their convention, the vote came up, should we stop talking about two things, God and Jerusalem? And the overwhelming response from the audience of delegates was cheering that the Democrat Party throw out God in issues surrounding Jerusalem. And I mean, I just think, I guess when we kind of boil this down to what's relevant to listeners today and listeners and loved ones in their lives, I just think we need to reexamine what progressives stand for. And if we can influence the listeners who have loved ones in their lives, even coworkers, neighbors, friends, let alone family members who are ardent progressives, and even worse than that, those who call themselves Christian progressives, I just think we need to bring up some of these issues because, as I said, this sentiment is morphing into a passion that was not seen since Nazi Germany, and that's a very, very strong statement. It's a very troubling one.
I'll tell you what, Jan, the distinction between the two major parties in this country when it comes to the issue of Israel and supporting the nation of Israel, I mean, it is black and white.
Right.
You have Democrats who, without apology, you have members of the Democratic Party we've talked about now who are out and out against Israel. You have the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement. that's being led by academia in this country, and it's just a cloak for anti-Semitism. So on and on it goes, and you had the Republican Party, and I honestly do believe, you know, in Genesis 12, 1 through 3,
yes, yes,
that the Trump administration is being blessed. Today, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, is going to the Western Wall with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, other leaders have gone, but without the Israeli leader. This is historic today, folks, because
it's
the United States saying we recognize all of Jerusalem as being under the control of Israel. Very significant, Jan.
Right. I just yesterday pre-recorded a program that doesn't air yet for another 10 days or so, but I had to pre-record because of Amir Sarfati, my guest. Amir is an Israeli Bible teacher, a prophecy teacher, and I talked to Amir, and it'll be airing on the programming last part of March here. And I asked him about these issues, and we talked about it for a full 10 minutes or so. From an Israeli perspective, just some of the things you're talking about, Fred, and I said to Amir, and I said, the Trump administration is the biggest gift to Israel ever, isn't it? And he said, absolutely. Now, we all know Harry Truman made a huge positive impact back in 1948, and we shouldn't take any credit away from him because he had advisors telling him, do not vote for this new independent nation of Israel back in 48. And he said, nuts to you, I'm going to vote for it. And I think he was the first to sign on. But having said all that, today the Trump administration and Mike Pompeo, who's an evangelical Christian, and who gets it biblically, and who also understands eschatology. Every now and then, he'll make statements like, boy, I'm waiting for the rapture, things like that. Pompeo gets it. A wonderful man to have in the position that he's in. But, yep, Fred, you're right. What happened here in the last few hours, very significant.
Jan, last question, and then we'll let you go. Do you think, I'm going to make a statement. I want you to know if you think I'm maybe too much hyperbole or maybe overestimating the spiritual angle in what we're talking about. Because when you talk about, Fred was mentioning the differences, the stark differences between the two political parties with regards to all things Israel and the growing anti-Semitism in the West, including now, it seems, in our country, even to the halls of Congress. Do you think it is a fair statement to say, because the Republican Party, by and large, it at least has the evangelical community as a large part of its base, while the Democratic Party is becoming increasingly secular.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Do you think that this is what we see in the West, that the further away from God a country gets or a political party gets, the more they're going to hate Israel because they are moving into spiritual darkness? And that is where the enemy lies, and Satan hates Israel and hates the Jews.
Boy, you know what? I can't add a thing to what you've said. You've summarized it perfectly. Absolutely, the progressive agenda is godless. And then there's nothing I can add to what you've said. You've summarized it just brilliantly. And I will add this one caveat that's positive. And that is more and more Jews are waking up. I heard Doug Schoen on Fox the other day say, if the Democrat, and he's an ardent Democrat and worked for Clinton, if the Democrats keep this up, he said, I am leaving the Democrat Party. And you've got other movements, Jexit, I think it's called, Jews breaking away from the Democrat Party. So a lot of Jews who remain, who do yet have a faith in God, some don't, of course, but those who have a belief in God are not going to stand for this much longer.
All right. Well, our guest has been Jan Markell, founder of Olive Tree Ministries. She's host of the radio program Understanding the Times, heard on weekends on American Family Radio, Saturday from 1 to 2 p.m. Central Time, Sunday from 12 to 1 p.m. Central Time. Jan, you want to give a little tease for what's coming up this weekend?
We're going to be talking about 10 reasons we're living in perilous times. That comes out of 2 Timothy 3 with Pastor Tom Hughes. I think your audience will resonate with it. So thank you for the opportunity. I sure appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Jan.
All right. Bye now.
Jan Markell, our guest. I do want to make clear that Jan Markell said that my comment was brilliant. Did you hear that?
Yeah, we're going to write a news story on that. That's breaking news.
I just want to remind people that that's exactly what she said.
Yeah, that's going to be played over and over again during Share-a-thon.
It will at my house, I can tell you that.
Ed's point is that kind of thing happens so rarely. We got to take note of it when it does.
That familiar voice that you just heard is Brian Fisher.
Going to be interviewed.
Yeah, we're going to have him on in about 10 minutes. No, folks, we're going to come right back to Brian here in just a moment. But I do want to remind you, and you've been hearing this on other programs on American Family Radio, because we have Share-a-thon. Our April Share-a-thon is coming up, oddly enough, in April, folks. So what we're doing now is we are gathering stories, listener stories, to play during our April Share-a-thon, and we would like to hear from you. And here's what we ask people to do, and we do this every Share-a-thon. If American Family Radio has made a difference in your life, we want to hear about it. And so what we do is we give you the opportunity to call and to leave basically a voicemail, a testimony, if you will, about how American Family Radio has impacted you. Maybe we were there at just the right time. Maybe you heard Brian Fisher say something important that helps you spiritually. Probably not, but we do have other people on American Family Radio. We have a lot of preaching ministries, and a lot of people have had their lives impacted at just the right time. We want that encouragement, the encouragement of your story and your testimony, to encourage others about American Family Radio.
And maybe you've heard Ed say other brilliant things that ought to be preserved.
That might have happened. You never know. It does happen rarely. So here's how you do that, folks. We have a listener storyline, and here's the number to call, 877-876-8893. You'll have prompts to let you know exactly how you are to do this. 877-876-8893. You call and share for a minute or two, and you might hear yourself during Share-a-thon or even in the lead-up to Share-a-thon. We would like to hear your AFR story. It could be a blessing and encouragement to others. All right. Now, we do have Brian Fisher on for a particular reason. Well, part of it was to harass me. That's okay. I'm used to it. No, Brian has written a new book, and I hope is going gangbusters. We're going to find out how it's doing from Brian. It's called The Boy to Man Book, Preparing Your Son for Manhood. Now, Brian, I can't think of anything that is more important in our day and age than getting that relationship right between fathers and sons. What led you to think that this was the subject of a book, and why now?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think if we want to reclaim America, we've got to reconnect fathers and sons. You know, the Bible is very clear that it's responsibility of fathers to bring their children, that includes their sons, to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And part of it is really two things contributed to the idea to write this book. One is that I was reading through the book of Proverbs. I read through the scriptures every 3 years, using a schedule that takes me through the whole counsel of God every 3 years. So I've read Proverbs now. I started that schedule in 1983. I've read through Proverbs a whole bunch of times. The last time I was reading through it, about 3 or 6 years ago, it struck me how many times Solomon in the book of Proverbs uses the phrase, my son. Yeah, I'm just looking at chapter 1 here. You know, he says in verse 9, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Verse 15, my son, do not walk in the way with them, and so forth and so on. 23 times, if you count them up, 23 times in the book of Proverbs, he uses that phrase. So it just kind of hit me kind of out of the blue that he really intended the book of Proverbs. And we look at that as a book of wisdom. And, you know, I know adults that read a chapter a day and all that and have for their whole adult lives. That's great. But it struck me that Solomon's intent in writing the book of Proverbs was to present a training manual for fathers with their sons. Another, here's the wisest man that ever lived, and he said, what I'm going to do in this book is I'm going to distill into this one book all of the wisdom that I want my son to know as he's on the glide path toward mature manhood. So I thought, well, this would be a pretty good place to go for a book, and maybe use that as kind of a template for writing a book on for fathers. The other thing is I wrote the book that I wish I'd had when my son was 12.
Yeah.
You know, because I think like a lot of fathers, and I wrote it not as a pastor for fathers, but as a father for fathers. I think a lot of us as dads, you know, we feel that responsibility to impart the wisdom of God into the lives and the hearts and the minds of our sons. We're just not really too sure how to go about it. And so while we're kind of spinning our wheels trying to figure out what the best approach is, time passes and the window is closed. You know, and there seems to be something magical about the 12-year mark and the way God has created us. You know, Dr. Dobson said the two most important years in a boy's life are age 5 and age 12. Hmm. And age 12, you know, you're starting to make the transition from being dependent on your family and now developing a wider circle of friends and making a move toward independence that culminates, you know, when you graduate high school and go off to college. That phase kind of reaches its end point there. And so I thought, well, you know, Jesus went through what's called the bar mitzvah. You know, it's common in Jewish circles. A lot of Protestant churches have confirmation basically at the same age. So they all recognize there's something critically important about that 12th year in a boy's life. You know, Jesus was found in the temple, you know, asking the teachers questions answering their questions. He was asking questions. They, in turn, recognized there was something special about this young 12-year-old boy. They started asking him questions, and he was there in the temple. Well, why was he there in the temple at age 12? We don't read about him being there any sooner. Well, he'd gone through the bar mitzvah, had become a son of the law, and in Jewish culture, when you went through that phase, age 12, you were expected, you were treated as an adult in terms of the law. You had adult responsibilities to obey the law. You know, so in other words, you know, in our culture, 14-year-old kid messes up, we go after his parents.
Yeah, right.
In Jewish culture, biblical society, 14-year-old acts up, they go after the 14-year-old. You're a man. We're expecting you to behave as a young man, no longer as a young boy. So you now are going to be held accountable for what you do. So that was kind of the genesis behind this book, and I went through the book of Proverbs to try to distill what Solomon had to say into a user-friendly format.
Well, that voice you're hearing, very familiar to our AFR listeners. It's Brian Fisher, host of Focal Point. We have Brian on today to discuss his new book, The Boy to Man Book, Preparing Your Son for Manhood.
Brian, based on your study of Proverbs, what are some of the key things that Proverbs teach dads to teach their sons? What are some of the key priorities?
Well, and I identified 24 major lessons that Solomon wanted his son to learn. I just went through the whole book of Proverbs. Mm-hmm. I categorized every verse and tried to identify the major themes he was addressing. So I've written a chapter devoted to each one of these 24 lessons. And you look at chapter 1, where he starts. I mean, that's a good place to figure out what Solomon's priorities were. You know, and the first thing he talks about says, I want my son to know that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and the beginning of wisdom. You know, if you want to get to wisdom, you want to get to knowledge, the place you have to start is with the fear of the Lord. So that's chapter 1, because that's what Solomon, the importance of developing a profound reverential relationship with God. The second thing he starts talking about is who you hang out with, who you run with, who your friends are. You know, because the quickest way for a young man to get in trouble is to run with the wrong crowd. So I have actually got a couple of chapters on that topic. I use illustrations from my own life about how God worked these things out for me. So that's just a place we go on. I go on in the book to talk about how to find a wife, you know, how to recognize when you have met the woman that you are to marry. Talking there about how far you can go on a date. You know, everybody wants to know that. And I went to seminars in college. And
you're talking like 10 miles away from home.
Yeah. You know, Ed's pretending he doesn't know.
Yeah, that. we'll have a talk after the show. Yeah.
No, but these are important issues that dads want to have maybe some instruction on how they can
talk to their son about these things. And you know, I went to these complicated seminars in college about where your hands can go and where they can't go. And I think there's a very simple kind of built-in distance early warning indicator that's absolutely infallible. Mm-hmm. And that if a young man learns to recognize this signal and learns to submit to it, he's going to stay out of trouble. Mm-hmm. So I've got chapters on work. There are chapters on, I got a chapter on pornography. You know, in England, 25% of the 12-year-old boys that are in long-term psychiatric facilities are addicted to pornography at age 12.
25%?
25%.
Wow.
You know, and there's a whole host of pathologies that go with that. There's isolation, there's guilt, there's shame, you know, all the kind of predictable things you think would go with that. So I've got a chapter devoted to the topic of pornography. So a dad is reading this to his son. That's the idea I've got behind the book. I want dads to read this to their sons. So the dad is the one who is imparting the wisdom of Solomon, and every chapter is chock full of verses from the book of Proverbs. And then there's a prayer at the end of every chapter he can pray into the life of his son that takes the theme of that chapter and builds a prayer around that.
I have a question. I'm married. I've got two daughters, and our cats are female. So I'm surrounded by women. But I want to help. What should somebody in my boat do? Is this something we can get and maybe, you know, recommend a friend or neighbor or church member that's got a son do?
Or let me just jump onto that question. Mm-hmm. Is this information that a dad could share or a mom could share with a daughter? Or is this specifically tailored to father-son?
Well, you know, it wouldn't hurt for a young daughter to read this book so she knows what to look for in a man. Hmm. Part of what prompted me to write this book, you know, when my daughter was that age, when she was her late teens, she couldn't find anybody in the body of Christ that interested her because they were all knuckleheads or immature or
and
whatever.
And you have a chapter in here about what to do about with knuckleheads. No, not really.
No, but, you know, it'd be good for them to know so they know what to look for in a man, what things are important in a man. You know, what a man's looking for in a wife, for instance, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think there's benefit for that. But there are other ways it can be used. Getting back to your question, Chris. In fact, I signed a book this morning right here at our front desk for a guy who is a Sunday school teacher in Tyler, Texas. And he's bought a copy of the book for every one of the fathers of the boys in his third to fifth grade Sunday school class. Hmm. Now, they're not 12 yet, but they're going to be. So each one of the dads of the boys in the Sunday school class is going to have a copy of this book courtesy of him. And so they can keep it handy for when the time comes and they can begin to, you know, introduce their son to the wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom of Proverbs.
Great. Well, we're talking with Brian Fisher, host of Focal Point. You recognize his voice. And we're just about done here. We're talking with him about his new book, The Boy to Man Book, Preparing Your Son for Manhood. Brian, one of the things that just kind of struck me, and then we're going to ask you to let our listeners know how they can get a copy of this book, as you include in the middle of the book some pictures of you and your son, J.D. I know you have a good relationship with him. You have some pretty funny little comments about some of this stuff. rocking our red satin jackets. Folks, if you want a good laugh, you see Brian's hairstyle there. The last thing I just wanted to mention is the fact that when you and I were growing up and when we were raising our sons, to some extent, the culture helped us mm-hmm. because it still had some strong Christian, currents in it. And so the culture helped dads with their sons and pointed them in the right direction regarding work and those mm-hmm. kind of things.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore. This book is probably more important now than ever before because culture is now actively working against the spiritual and emotional well-being of our sons. How do people get a hold of the copy of this book?
Well, if you want to buy something from AFA, the logical place to go is afastore.net. Go to afastore.net. Right now, I think you can probably find it right on the front page. You click on it, and you'll have a chance to buy a copy or multiple copies for yourself.
All right, great idea. Give it to folks who may have sons, as Chris mentioned, or as the brother who came to our offices today buying them for dads in Sunday school classes. The Boy to Man Book from Brian Fisher. All right, folks. Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome, and Ed, I think you are a brilliant man.
Two people today have said it. 5-minute break for news. We'll be right back with more of today's issues.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.